Can you exegete this photograph here? This is the aftermath of a hurricane from 1998, Hurricane Mitch in Honduras. And this huge hurricane formed out in the Caribbean, moved west across the Caribbean, did the absolute worst possible thing. When the eye of the hurricane came near the coast of Honduras, the eye stopped. And here in Florida, people appreciate this. And it just stayed there for 5 days. And for 5 days, it just basically wobbled, which meant for those 5 days, it was hurling rain over onto Central America. In Honduras, you might remember there was a volcano. You sort of imagine like a cinder cone of, like a sand, or a sand castle, or a sugar, you know, pile. And with rain falling for, torrential rain falling for 7 days, the volcano just suddenly squashed. And there were cities, little villages all around, and they just were gone. I mean, couldn't count survivors, nothing. They were just completely gone. Honduras suffered the most. This is very hard to imagine, but you really have to try to imagine that in that week, 100 inches of rain fell. You try to imagine, you know, over 8 feet of rain. The result was, this is the Choluteca River, which is kind of it runs through the capital city of Tegucigalpa, which at that point, it's normally kind of a small river. It just flooded the capital city, which is way up in the mountains. Well, by the time all the rain from the mountains came down to the coastal plain near the Caribbean, this is where this picture is taken. There's actually a town called Choluteca on the Caribbean coast. The river was no longer a river of water. It was a river of mud. They said it looked like caramel, or it looked like butterscotch. And it had scoured the entire, you know, it was taking away the topsoil of Honduras and bringing it out into the Caribbean. Well, this bridge had just been built, and there was a road on either side of it, but when the floodwaters came, it washed away the road on either side. And then when the floodwaters receded, the riverbed was in a new place, leaving this no longer a bridge. It's the structure formerly known as a bridge, because a bridge, by definition, helps you cross from one thing to another. And this doesn't help you do anything, except for the following 8 years, it became a tourist attraction as people visited from both roads. Oddly, too, this bridge was donated to the people of Honduras by the nation of Japan. And they were very proud of the bridge, as they should have been. I mean, it's pretty impressive with that kind of a flood that the bridge stood structurally intact, although it's worthless. And just so you know the end of the story, last year the Japanese came back, because this was classified a 1 in 100,000 year storm. So they weren't worried about this happening again anytime soon. So last year, the Japanese came and took bulldozers and rerouted the river under the bridge, and then built up. They had to build huge mounds, you know, and then rebuilt the road. So it's operational again. But I think, in some ways, this is a great metaphor. This sets up my understanding of how history works and culture works. You know, rain always falls 100 inches. Falls in Honduras, you know, on an average year in the Caribbean. What's unusual, though, is to have 100 inches of rain condensed into a week, you see. And in a similar way, rivers are always moving, you know, grain by grain, pebble by pebble, erosion is happening. But when you have extraordinary amount of change, then the river moves to a completely new location. And this seems to be how history works. If any of you have read Thomas Cahill, How the Irish Saved Civilization, Desire of the Everlasting Hills, Thomas Cahill says, you see history moving along a trajectory, and then there are certain places, he calls them hinges, where the trajectory suddenly changes. And then you go back to a normal, and then another hinge where, or another way to say it, is to say that there is evolution, constant erosion, and then there's revolution, unprecedented, concentrated, dramatic change, and then you return to a period of evolution, and then another period of revolution, and so on. So whether you're looking at the development of life in the fossil record, you have like development, the Cambrian explosion, then new development, you know, things like this. Just seems to be the way things work. And when you think about how this affects the church, well, one way to say it is when you go to Europe, where church attendance is anywhere from less than 1%, I don't think it's higher than 10% anywhere in Europe. You know, the church in many ways is this structure. It's a tourist attraction. More people visit the cathedrals as tourists to look at the stained glass windows than visit them as worshipers. Same is true in many cities in the Northeast. You know, you go to Boston, if you've been to Boston, a lot of old churches are now health clubs, condos, theaters, restaurants, because whatever happened to the congregation, it didn't survive a period of revolution. So that's kind of my framework. This is the picture of the floods. This is in the capital city, where it's way up in the mountains. The river is usually small there. It's quite dramatic. And I think Peter has some sense about this when he talks about us always being ready to give an answer for the reason of our hope. The word always suggests over time you have to, this is going to continue. You could say it like this. A lot of us are perfectly prepared to answer the questions that were being asked in the 16th century. And others of us are perfectly prepared to answer the questions that were being asked in the 1970s. But some of us believe that since the 1970s, we had another hurricane. We might still be in it. But it's a hurricane of a lot of change being condensed together so that new questions are being asked and so that the landscape is changing. And my little model for this is if you start with the shift from the prehistoric world to the historic world, which comes about largely through the invention of writing, around 2500 BC. When you think about it, let's do a quick, brain scan. How would writing change civilization? Imagine civilization before and after writing. Some ideas?
Keep track of what
you've learned. Okay, keep accumulating knowledge. You can send messages long distances that are really exactly the same message. How would it do that?
Because you have to remember if you write
it. Marshall McLuhan said, every innovation is an amputation. So the more you can write down, the less you develop memory. Very true. Yeah?
Loss of myth and storytelling, maybe?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, isn't it? To think that, Homer's works were originally memorized, you see, and so much of the Old Testament was carried on through oral tradition, and that's something that writing makes less necessary. Just like I don't know my parents' phone number for the first time because they moved and it's in my cell phone, so I don't have to remember it, I keep thinking I ought to learn it, but I don't know how to use my cell phone well enough to find it. But some other things? Faster communication, yes. Well, think about this. Can you have world religions? Can you have sacred texts? No Bible, no Quran, no Upanishads, no Bhagavad Gita. What we think of as religion, the kind of religion that develops in civilization, develops because of the ability to write. Pretty important. No Bible, without writing. So whatever forms religion had before 2500 BC, they were going to radically change with the invention of books. And really, what the big change is, when you have writing, the big change is accounting and government, because you can keep track of complex business transactions, property, this sort of thing. You can start to build a big economy and a big government. And that's what emerges. We call the ancient world the world of civilizations. When you can create these larger geopolitical units that depend on writing for their structure. And these words, these names are familiar to us because empire is the backdrop against which the biblical story happens. Abraham with the Sumerians, Moses with the Egyptians, and so on. So we have this succession of empires that are familiar to us because they're the backdrop for the Bible. And in fact, this to me is a really interesting subject that we don't study much in studying the Bible, but you start to realize it's a huge theme. What's the relationship of the people of God to empire? And what we call idolatry is actually deeply part of imperial religion. So it's not just a matter of our God and your God. It's a matter of our God, who's not a God of an empire, and your idols, who are complicit, who are the religious expression of empire. There's a lot more going on there that when you start paying attention, the Bible just starts fizzing, you know, with another dimension. But something fascinating happens. We have this succession of great empires around the Mediterranean. This is a very Eurocentric telling of the story, which is part of the problem, but we'll get back to that in a minute. But then around 500 AD, I think we have another hurricane, because the last of these great civilizations, the Roman Empire, thus these great empires, is disintegrated and fragmented. The Visigoths and the Goths and the Huns, you know, basically, and the empire's own overreactions to the terrorism of the terrorists. I mean, history is amazingly echoing, and you can imagine if the United States becomes too terrified, then we start spending more and more money on national defense, and then we bankrupt our economy, and you can just imagine the whole thing turning into a really big a downward spiral, which is what happens to Rome over a couple of hundred years. But what's fascinating is by the time the Roman Empire really, you know, signs its bankruptcy statement, the barbarians invade Rome around 500, and the Roman Senate all vacates, and they never come back. And then the leading families of the city come to Pope Gregory and basically say, "Hey, look, there's nobody to run the empire. Can you pick up the pieces for us?" And in a way, that gives birth to a new era. That's like a hurricane, because now what we end up with is what we call the medieval world. When the church now is the custodian of Western civilization and society rearranges itself and the old bridge of the Roman Empire doesn't work, and now we have to create new structures. And so that brings up this new period that basically goes roughly 500 AD to 1500 AD. And around 1500 AD, think about the hurricane that forms, the hurricane of change. A lot of it related to new technology. The end of the Roman Empire is not so much related to new technology. It's it's related to the confrontation of the best technology, swords, spears, shields, armor, chariots, with numbers of barbarians who are, by their sheer numbers, are able to overwhelm the technology, you know. And because they resent what that technology is doing, it's creating a privileged class of Roman citizens who are so far removed from the desperately poor people who don't have those privileges. And that unrest helps lead to this. But we get to 1500 AD and we have new printing technology. I mean, the printing press, the advances made in the printing press around 1500, it's the biggest breakthrough in communication technology since the invention of writing. In 2500 BC. And then you think new transportation technology, the multi-masted sailing vessel, the caravel. And the caravel changes the world. This is why the Eurocentric telling of the story it's not legitimate, but I mean, I'm not saying it ought to be this way, but this is what happened. Because you had new transportation and new weapons technology. First guns, then cannons. And when you put cannons on ships, the world changes. If you saw the movie Master and Commander, remember the scene when they're trying to improve the speed of firing the cannons, and Russell Crowe's character is timing them, and when they all shoot, he says, "You got to do better than that, boys, or pretty soon your grandchildren will be speaking bonjour," or something like that. And what he means is, when you put cannons on ships, whichever nation controls the seas controls the global economy, and their empire will rule the world. So it's the unleashing of a new empire after 1,000 years without that kind of empire, and new economy, because now gold and all the other products of the world start pouring into Europe, and so now Europe basically begins to dominate the world. New scientific worldview through Copernicus and Galileo. And then, of course, Martin Luther is challenging the authority of the church that's been dominant for 500 years. Put all of those pieces together, I think you'll agree, you've got a hurricane, and the world that emerges from the hurricane, the map is different, and we call it the modern world. I'll say more about that in a minute, but you just think about the shift that happens in terms of worldview from the earth in the center of the universe through Galileo and Copernicus to seeing the sun in the center of the universe and the earth spinning and going around it. I mean, you know that Copernicus was called by the office of the Inquisition, please come down to Rome, we'd like to have a chat. And by the way, this is related because in 1610, he wrote his book with his new theory of the sun-centered universe. And in 1611, it was being read all across Europe because of the printing press. And so they invite him down, I think in 1613, and they say, let's have a talk. And they say, if you don't recant what you wrote in the book, we're going to tear your skin off your body while you're still alive. And, you know, Galileo said, well, I'll think about that, you know. Can you give me some time? And so he thinks about it, and they do some negotiating, and it's a bad pun, but he finds a way to save his skin. But the book, the cat's out of the bag. The book is out there, and telescopes are being invented and all the rest. So the old universe is going to die. Why would the Catholic Church threaten torture on an old man, probably around 70 years old? Why would they use torture on an old man? He might have been closer to 80, come to think of it. But why would they threaten torture? It wasn't because they were that concerned about science. It was for the same reason that people are concerned about six-day creationism, a lot of other things. It's because they have a system that and an understanding of the universe that goes together with the gospel in their mind. And if that system goes down, the gospel goes down with it. They could never imagine that the gospel could manage to disentangle itself from that medieval worldview. And that the medieval worldview, scientific, political, economic, could go down. The gospel could in some way hover long enough until a new worldview began to emerge. And in fact, the church helped create the new worldview, and that's what we call the modern worldview. Just to give you a feeling of this, in 1611, John Donne wrote this poem, "The New Philosophy Calls All in Doubt." Now, by philosophy, he means the sun-centered universe. "The new philosophy calls all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost and the earth, and no man's wit can well direct him where to look for it." I think that was a big laugh line in 1611. And you understand, we can't find the sun, we can't find the earth. "'Tis all in pieces, all coherence gone, all just supply and all relation. Prince, subject, father, son, are things forgot. And every man alone thinks he hath got to be a phoenix, and there can be none of that kind of which he is but he." Do you feel the unrest of that? He's saying the loss of the order of that physical universe is going to lead to the loss of social order and civilization, because princes, subjects will stop obeying princes, sons will stop obeying fathers, and God help us when the women stop obeying men. See? And that hierarchical universe that matched the old model, in fact, it's the model of the great chain of being where everything is hierarchy. If we lose that, if we see the world as dynamic and spinning, see, oh boy, we're in big trouble. But of course, that's the world that emerged. And in fact, and a new worldview formed, and John Calvin and others played a big part, but especially Sir Isaac Newton. And when Newton died, Alexander Pope wrote this epitaph. Actually, he wrote it before Newton died to be ready, a little bit like, you know, on CNN, they're always working on the obituary of old people so that when they die, they can put it up. "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." And see, Newton gave us a metaphor, the laws of nature. And that metaphor then creates space. So our theologies start talking about law. Theology is all about law and grace, from Martin Luther, John Calvin, and beyond. And you know, there's law in the Bible. But my personal belief is, in the modern era, law just suddenly becomes more important until you get the four spiritual laws, which begins, just as there are physical laws which govern the physical universe, there are spiritual laws. Now, I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm just saying it's very, very modern. Because when you say physical laws, that's Sir Isaac Newton. No medieval person knew about the four spiritual laws. And no medieval person would have said, just as there are laws which govern the physical universe, because they didn't think in terms of laws of nature. That concept didn't even exist. All of that's to give you some feeling for how contextual our theology is and our worship and all the rest. And so I'm just going to move ahead. So a lot of us believe that we've been part of this modern world from 1500, all of our theological systems, Calvinism, dispensationalism, Pentecostal theology, Wesleyan theology. Even Roman Catholic theology has rebooted twice in the modern era. First Council of Trent, 1613, then Vatican II. In a certain sense, all of our Christian religious institutions have formed or reformed in the modern era. And we've done so within its universe and in its assumptions. But then a lot of us look at what's happened in the last 50 years or so, and some people think we're completely wrong, but we look at the convergence of change. We look at how, yeah, change always happens, but when a hurricane stays for you for about 70 years, you expect there... Think about it. New communication technology, the screen and the internet, the movie screen, television screen, and then the computer and the internet. How will that affect our society? And then, and we aren't done yet, because then, you know, when the internet is available on a handheld device, or when the internet is available on an implant, or you know, who knows what it's going to be? But we're just there's evidence that we're in the middle of maybe the most profound communication revolution in history, maybe more significant than the invention of writing to begin with. In terms of its effects on the world, because it's an instantaneous and global communication system. And then new science. I mean, the changes from the medieval worldview to Sir Isaac Newton were big, but the changes from Sir Isaac Newton to Einstein and since Einstein are no less radical. I mean, all of us were taught in school that the universe is composed of protons, neutrons, and electrons, but physicists know that that's not true. They know that that's a very simplified thing to explain to common people like us, like telling children that babies come on storks, you know. Do babies come on storks? Well, you could probably turn the stork into the metaphor for the, you know, fallopian tubes or something. You know what I'm saying? You could find, but scientists say, look, the universe is so much richer than little marbles spinning around little, you know, tennis balls. It's just, in fact, the contemporary physicist is very relevant to what Daryl said in the chapel this morning. They tell us they think that when you keep breaking down the parts, you know, quarks, nuons, muons, gluons, etc., eventually you break things down so small that you realize there's nothing there except vibration. So that gets pretty weird. But it also gets pretty amazing, because in the beginning was the Word. Starts to feel like, you know, that's it. It's the vibration, you know, but by the way, part of that old world laws of nature was the world is divided into matter and energy, natural and supernatural. Those are assumptions of ours that we think are in the Bible. They're not in the Bible. They were from a previous worldview, and they probably won't be in this new universe either. Those old dualisms, matter and energy, natural, supernatural. So it's just such a different world. We don't have to say anything about new weapons technology in this world, because we haven't begun to figure out how it changes the world when you have, first of all, nuclear weapons, which are in our headlines every day. Then you have biological and chemical weapons. And then you start combining nuclear weapons with rockets, which we thought was really bad. But now we're more worried about combining nuclear weapons in suitcases on airplanes or in trucks. So suddenly the world, you know, this changes the world. new economy with a global economy, not just the global economy, but you know, all of our economies are based on being able to tax income and tax transactions. But what happens when transactions happen on the internet and don't have any country in which they can be taxed? This is a huge crisis. They're talking about the United Nations, World Bank, etc. Huge issues, and a new spirituality, because the old assumptions of that I'm in a religion and they tell me what to think, and they're the only show in town. That's no longer true, because you go to in the morning you stop at a convenience store and you meet people from three different world religions, and your children go to school and they're with people with four other religions, and you know what I'm saying? We're thrown together in a new way. We don't feel stable in this modern worldview, and we're going through this change. And so you might say we live in three worlds on one planet. We have people who live in a pre-modern world or a non-modern world, and then we have people who live in a modern world, and then we have this emerging world, and very often you have them in the same family. Some of you think, yeah, that's so grandpa and grandma, especially if they're immigrants, you know, they come from a world. To me, the easiest way to identify the pre-modern world, they're people who live without books. And then you have the world of books, and then you have this other world. And it's fascinating. So you could be in a little, I was in Central America last summer, and there's a tiny little village where almost nobody speaks Spanish, because it's the pre-colonial, indigenous languages, pre-modern world. And then Spanish represents the modern world, because the modern world is also the colonial world. And we're going to talk about this more tomorrow. And then we move into this emerging world. And so you have grandpa and grandma here, mom and dad here, and the kids are playing video games, and they are on the internet, and they're, you know, connecting to the rest of the world. Just quite amazing. And there's a lot of ways we can talk about how these transitions work. We don't need to go into any of these in great depth, although I'm happy to answer any questions. But it's not saying the left column is good, or the left column is bad, and the right column is good. Characteristics of modernity: conquest, control, progress. We move. But in fact, let me just use that as one example, because the last 500 years are the era of the conquistadors. And one way to understand contemporary events is to say that in the 16th to 20th centuries, we had European imperialism. Europe controlled the world. Now, in 1776, we escaped. We had a revolution. In the 1800s, Latin America had their revolution from Spain and Portugal. But Europe continued to control Africa and much of Asia until after World War II. So you could say that it was the conquest of the world first by Europe, but then we could say the conquest of the world by America, because now America, media, military, all the rest is dominant. And if you want to understand Islam's reaction to America, you have to understand, for Islam, we're just the latest in the succession of Christian empires that are trying to squeeze them out of the world. And you might disagree with that, but that's how it feels. And if you don't understand that's how it feels, you know, in your marriage, if you don't understand how your partner feels, it doesn't matter whether you're right. And in fact, you're not. So we have this era of conquest and control, and that is equated with progress. The more the world becomes European, the better it is. The more the world becomes American, the better it is, right? Regime change, make them like us, see? So it's a very deep, deep-seated 500-year trajectory. But what happens when you start saying, you know what, we don't think it's that good that the rest of the world becomes like us? Then you want to conserve the things that were different. And so when you talk about we've got to maintain diversity or celebrate diversity, part of that is a reaction against the sameness of colonialism and colonization, you see. You could use the example 500 years ago, virtually everyone in the world had to be careful when they went out at night because of wolves, lions, tigers, and bears. Not just on The Wizard of Oz. Oh, my. But today, we're still worried about lions, tigers, wolves, and bears, but we're not worried about them making us extinct. We're worried about us making them extinct. So the things we used to try to kill, now we're trying to conserve. You see, it's that shift. We control the environment so much, we are almost pushing them out of existence. So now we have to conserve them. Now, here's where it becomes interesting theologically, and in fact, related to worship. Remember in 2002, after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, or no, before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the Taliban was in control. And remember they blew up those pre-Islamic statues in eastern Afghanistan, Buddhist statues, kind of like Mount Rainier. They blew them up. Now, let's just do a little survey here. How many of you think it was morally wrong for the Taliban to blow up the statues? How many of you would say that was morally wrong? They shouldn't have done it. Okay. How many of you think, let me change it. Let's imagine that it wasn't the Taliban in control of Afghanistan. Let's say it was Baptists in control of Afghanistan. How many of you think it would be morally wrong for Baptists to blow up the Buddhist statues? Okay. I won't ask you to raise your hands on this, but how many of you would say, in the name of Jesus Christ, we should preserve Buddhist statues? And let's take it, because you know what the statues are. Why did the Taliban destroy them? They're idols. How many of you would say, in the name of Jesus Christ, we should preserve Buddhist idols? See, because what we're saying, if you raise your hand then, and I would, you're saying that we've gone so far in the era of conquest that now, in the name of Christ, we have to preserve things that we're in danger of destroying that are part of God's creation. And if you think that's heretical, just remember, we wouldn't know today about Zeus and Aphrodite and Hermes and all the rest if Christians didn't decide at some point to stop destroying all the statues of Greek and Rome and say, you know what, there is cultural meaning and artistic beauty to be preserved here, and we should know about it. Now, that's a long monologue. The last one is we have national moves to global and migratory. I think that this is one of the shifts in generations. This isn't purely generational, but one of the shifts in generations is I think the younger you go, the more global people are. And the more they think in terms of the globe, not just my denomination and my nation, but they're thinking in terms of the world. I've spent maybe half my time in the global south, you know, in the last couple of years. Maybe not half, but a lot of my time in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. Philip Jenkins says, the way things are going, in 100 years, to speak of a white Christian might sound like speaking of a Swedish Buddhist today. Because Christian faith is exploding in the global south. I could give you a lot of statistics on that, and I'll just tell you, for those of you who've read Philip Jenkins, The Next Christendom, I really think his research is important. It's not the last word. And let me just give you an example. I was in East Africa last month with 140 East Africans, 20 South and West Africans, and 40 Westerners who were guests for their conference talking about what's emerging. Now, they don't talk postmodern. See, we can talk modern, postmodern. They talk postcolonial. And I actually think we should start talking postcolonial more than postmodern. I have an article about this in a book called An Emergent Manifesto of Hope, if you're interested in this. But they're talking about this because what they realize is every viewpoint they have on Christianity came through white European missionaries who had some wonderful strengths, but who also had some pretty serious weaknesses. Let's just talk about one. The genocide in Rwanda, 800,000 people killed in 100 days, took place in one of the top three most highly church-attending countries in the world. The place where what's called the East African Revival began. So if you're Catholic, you're embarrassed. If you're Anglican, you're embarrassed. And if you're charismatic, you're embarrassed, because all three had a very deep effect in Rwanda. And so these were highly church-going people who killed each other as never before. But the same is true in many other Christianized places. So whatever understanding of the gospel they were given, that understanding of the gospel maybe told them how to go to heaven, but it didn't tell them how to avoid creating hell. See? And of course, in a certain sense, it couldn't, because if you were to emphasize the dimensions of the gospel that say we ought to treat other human beings well, it would have called into question colonialism itself. So in the aftermath of colonialism and the aftermath of colonialism, these young Christians are now starting to say, we believe in Jesus, we believe in the gospel, but now we've got to try to see the things that we weren't seeing when we only saw the gospel through the eyes of the Europeans. Christianity in the last 500 years, in its Catholic and Protestant forms, has become a modern religion. Now, you could say there are medieval forms of Catholicism and there are medieval forms of Eastern Orthodoxy. I think that's true. And in some places, those are dominant. But we could say that by and large, Protestant Christianity is a modern religion. When people leave the pre-modern world and enter modernity, Christianity is waiting for them to welcome them. In fact, if I go here, we could say it like this, that when people move from here to here, they either lose their religion or they become Christian. Okay? But when they move from here to here, there's no religion waiting for them. And one way to describe, and this maybe is a long way around back to your question, is I think the best way to talk about the emergent church or whatever, it's people who are trying to figure out what it looks like to be Christians in this world. And in a sense, they're going as missionaries across the border into a whole new culture, radically different culture. Just as the missionaries here went back into this world, bringing the modern gospel into a pre-modern world, you see. A lot of African theologians and pastors especially are saying, they're saying a couple things. One is that the form of Christianity that is exploding in the modern world is the prosperity gospel. In my experience, the most powerful, I've been in 24, 25 countries in the last 18 months, probably 30 countries in the last couple of years, 35 in the last couple of years. The most powerful Christian in the world is Benny Hinn. I mean, if the blessing of God is shown by numbers, Benny Hinn's got to be the most blessed guy in the world. It's explosive. And what they're saying is that form of Christianity that in a way is a fusion of three fascinating things. It takes part of the pre-modern world, which is the belief in luck and the belief in fate and the belief that you don't have much control over your actions. It's controlled by invisible forces. And mixes that with a kind of modern Christianity and then mixes that with capitalism, where the purpose of life is to get ahead. And when you put those three things together, that's sort of the cocktail of the prosperity gospel. Now, there's a lot we could say about that, and maybe I could just say that I actually think there's something about the prosperity gospel that's a step up from what they had before. Because when you're desperately poor, when I was in Uganda, I had dinner with four members of parliament, and Benny Hinn was coming to town. I asked them, what do you think of Benny Hinn? Oh, they said, we like Benny. I said, why do you like Benny? They said, oh, he gives the people hope. And our people are so poor, and they have no hope. And when you have no hope, you don't even try anything. You just get by. And Benny gives them hope. I said, what happens if Benny gives them promises that their life will get better, and then 4 months later, their life is no better? One of them said, oh, then they'll be disillusioned. Said, but that's where they started anyway. And his idea was, look, if somebody's coming giving them a little bit of hope, and if it works for, because if they have hope, they'll try something, and if they try something, that's better than nobody trying anything, see? I could see what he meant, right? And if the old gospel, and believe me, it said this to people, not intentionally. My grandfather was a missionary in Africa. I love him. You know, he's a hero to me. I don't want to be critical of the missionaries. They were just a reflection of all of us, you know. But if the missionaries basically said to the poor people, I know you're poor, and I know I come from England and we're very prosperous, but love God and pray and read the Bible and don't smoke and don't drink and don't gamble you'll go to and have the right doctrine. You know, don't follow the Pentecostals over there. We got the right doctrine, you know. And you know, love God. You're going to go to heaven someday. And it was really appealing when Jesus might come back today. So you'll go, and if you're not ready, you'll go to hell. But if you're ready, you'll go to heaven. And so, you know, and what that did is that sort of put Evelyn in the situation of not having to think of the long-term future. And of not having to have hope in this world. And it, you know, in a way for Benny to say, you're really poor and God wants to bless you and help you take a step out of poverty. Benny's offering them hope, you see. So it's so complex, isn't it? But what my East African friends are saying is when they move here, there's no Christianity. One last anecdote about this and then we'll take our break. I was in Kenya. And I had dinner with a dozen young professional Kenyans. And it was interesting. All of them were two generations removed from the village. So their grandparents were here. Perfectly describes them. Their parents moved to the city, were here. And now they're moving here. And one young woman works for an NGO in Sudan. And, you know, Uganda, Kenya, they're trying to help Southern Sudan because Southern Sudan's going to have elections in 2010 to become an independent nation. And they say we can't afford a failed nation state because that will create huge problems for us. So they're really pouring a lot of aid and help into Southern Sudan. So this young woman works in Sudan. 3 months she lives in Sudan. 1 month comes back to Nairobi. She said, everybody in my NGO is a Kenyan. Everybody grew up in the church. And everybody is an atheist or an agnostic except me. And she said, but if you ask them, what is it they don't believe? She said, they've rejected the God of Kenyan prosperity theology. Because when you see poverty and you see it not working, you know, and you don't see the easy answers working. She said, the problem is, if you reject the God of Kenyan prosperity theology, there is no alternative. So they become agnostics or atheists. See? She says, I'm trying to tell them there's an alternative, but when all they see is this, they can't imagine anything over here. Well, maybe that's a good framework to set us up for where we'll go after the break. You know, we have 5 minutes for some more questions. Yes. What I'd say is seeing the world in terms of law and gospel is one way to see the world. You could also see the world in terms of war and peace, sustainability and unsustainability, xenophobia and reconciliation. You know, there are a lot of different things you could see. And I think good Lutherans see those as law and gospel. All of them are brought together under law and gospel. For non-Lutherans, I would translate it to say, it's not just in those terms. In fact, let me say it this way. I hope your coming to this class won't pollute you in the eyes of some of your friends, because I know some people, I read what people say about me sometimes, and I just think, gosh, I would hate that guy if I knew him, you know? But what I know some of my critics say, what these people want to do is they want to water down the gospel and accommodate it to the postmodern world, which has really low standards, so that's really watered down, you know? And what I want to say to them is, no, I don't think that's right. I mean, that's certainly a danger. It's always a danger. What I want to do is help us face how much we already watered things down to fit in the modern context. and how much we've already accommodated to the modern Western European rationalist enlightenment and colonial Eurocentric context. And if we can question that and find out what the gospel looks like once it's let out of that cage, that's, you know, what I'm interested in. The problem is, and the reason why your original question that's got us going here, when people say the emergent church, is that that assumes we know what it looks like and that it looks like one thing. What to me is very exciting, and maybe what a group of people like you have the capacity to do, is we, and maybe what these 2 days, our highest hope could be, is that we venture sort of here to the ledge of the Grand Canyon, you know, and we sort of stand at the ledge and we try to get the view, and we imagine what it could be, you know, on the other side or something. We say, what can happen as the gospel moves forward? And the place we want to focus on that is in the area of spiritual formation. And that's where we're going to go after the break. I want to talk about, because I'll explain this after the break, but those of us, especially from evangelical backgrounds, tend to focus on the making of Christians or the making of born-again Christians or born-again Bible-believing Christians or born-again Bible-believing Spirit-filled Christians or born-again Bible-believing Spirit-filled Christians who know about the fivefold ministry, or, you know, we have a lot of adding things, but it's a certain thing here. And those of us from mainline churches tend to think about how do we make people who are good, whatever, but who cherish the institutions that we've grown to love. And you know, we have these two things. And I think what part of what's emerging in this time is something that's very ancient and future. And the ancient is to understand the forming of disciples as being very, very central to what we're about. Not just Christians, but actual disciples, see? And the asking of what that means in today's world. That's part of what's going on here, and that's where we'll go. And then we're going to talk tomorrow about how public worship can be seen as playing a role in the formation of disciples.